started in the streets of Denver, Colorado last spring. Days after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, I watched dozens of people marching with anguish and affliction on their faces. Several of them were crying, or clearly had been. When I watched the video of the final moments of George Floyd's life, I myself felt the telltale symptoms of grief. A clenched stomach, a surge of adrenaline, and an overwhelming sense of powerlessness. The article you're about to hear has been written by David W. McIver, an associate professor of political science at Colorado State University and the author of Mourning in America, Race and the Politics of Loss. The piece is titled, May 25th Should Be a Day of Mourning for George Floyd. Stay with us for more of David McIver's article. When the protests started in the streets of Denver, Colorado last spring, days after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, I watched dozens of people marching with anguish and affliction on their faces. Several of them were crying, or clearly had been. When I watched the video of the final moments of George Floyd's life, I myself felt the telltale symptoms of grief, a clenched stomach, a surge of adrenaline, and an overwhelming sense of powerlessness. As they unfolded over the next days and weeks, the protests seemed like a moment when black grief, a feeling familiar for black Americans after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, Trayvon Martin, Emmett Till, and so many others, might finally become collective grief for the rest of America. The crowds were multiracial, united, emotive, insistent. They marched night after night, giving the unfolding events of last May and June a dreamlike quality, magnified by the fact that they took place in the similarly surreal days of COVID-19 lockdowns. It was a time full of unexpected surprises. Minneapolis said it would dismantle its police department. Deep uncertainty, can it do that? And wild swings between hope and anguish. Possibility and anxiety. Maybe it was just a moment, though, a brief disruption of a relatively unchanging situation. Violence against black lives has continued since the day George Floyd was murdered. Meanwhile, the brief and striking shift in public opinion towards the Black Lives Matter social movement steadily declined, especially among white Americans. Political debate and partisan identities have returned to their familiar polarized pattern. Popular discourse once again largely dissociates from black pain. One year later, it is easy to be cynical about this moment of collective grief. But there is another way of thinking about this, that is still possible to build on the moment of shared grief over the death of George Floyd in order to see a way towards a more democratic and just coexistence. There is an intimate yet still unexplored relationship between mourning and democracy. We tend to see mourning as a temporary disruption of normal life, a cycle of pain, denial, and eventually acceptance. This picture is both right and wrong. Mourning is a movement towards wholeness by way of acknowledging brokenness, but it is less a terminable process than a way of being in the world. To see this better, we have to appreciate the role that attachment and ambivalence play in mourning. Mourning implies attachment. We mourn only for those to whom we are connected, or for that to which we are committed. In the case of George Floyd, who became a public figure only through his death, the communal mourning that followed was less about the specific life that was lost than the democratic ideals that were so clearly violated. The right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that was extinguished for Mr. Floyd and for too many others. Public mourning, then, is the expression of grief when the longing for social recognition and equal justice is unrequited. Mourning also confronts us with an experience of ambivalence. It is a pivot between life and death, past and future, love and hatred, openness and defensiveness, and reparation and destruction. A democratic politics of mourning implies not only the clarification of our public ideals and commitments, our civic attachments, but also a wrestling with the ambivalence in American history and American psyches. Mourning is the work not only of integrating what has been lost into our personality, but also of integrating the personality itself, our fears and our hopes, our vulnerabilities and our power. To do this, we first have to overcome the defenses that dissociate us from the pain of loss, our own pain and that of others. Often in times of grief, narratives of innocence and immorality, of absolute good and abject evil, deflect or defend against an experience of ambivalence. Instead of a complex picture of identity and history that might inspire dialogue and collaborative action, the raw energy of mourning is channeled through the quick and relatively easy identification of scapegoats or magical fixes. But public mourning can also manifest something different, precisely because it can open up a dreamlike space of possibility. This is what the psychoanalyst Dr. D.W. Winnicott called potential space. For Dr. Winnicott, cultural activities like a protest, although he did not use that example, are both real and surreal. They take place in the realm of shared reality, but they are not reducible to this reality because they are also imbued with aspects of dreaming, such as free association, playful juxtaposition, and a fluid sense of time. It is the dreamlike nature of cultural life that makes creativity possible, what Dr. Winnicott linked to play. Following Dr. Winnicott, we see mourning as a space where we acknowledge loss and ambivalence by playing with the possibilities for different, more creative responses to loss. And this brings me back to the George Floyd protests. The initial protests occurred in potential space, a mixture of dream and reality, and despite the resumption of familiar discourses in their wake, there are signs that new possibilities have emerged from that moment. For example, there is a notable spike of interest in truth and reconciliation processes and racial equity initiatives. The Divided Community Project at the Ohio State University recently published a practical guide for such initiatives, which could take place in networks of civic associations, within school districts, or at municipal, state, or national levels. No doubt, any such efforts would be imperfect, but they would also represent tentative steps into a democratic work of mourning with unknown consequences. What we do know is that conversations across social difference can result in greater levels of understanding and trust. We have a proof of concept, but we can lack larger structures or rituals of this kind of work. Yet a hunger for those labors clearly exists, which can be built upon. What would happen if we thought creatively about how to mourn as a society? George Floyd's story is inseparable from his tragic death, and any commemoration should not shy away from the fact. So one possibility would be to make 25th of May, the day that George Floyd was murdered, a day of both public commemoration and public reflection. It could help highlight the ongoing dysfunctions of American democracy while creating opportunities for public dialogue and public work. It could be a day of protest and service. In light of America's tragic history and its continuing challenges of violence, disrespect, and unequal access to liberty. 25th of May could become a day of public mourning, understood as a space for sharing not just grief about the present world, but also aspirations for a world that Americans could build together. A day of mourning would open up potential spaces in American politics, even if momentarily, and recapture some of the dreamlike quality of that brief time when, after George Floyd's murder, another world seemed possible.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Come on. It's time to get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon his word, and I cling only to his cord. In thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to the debate. A ceasefire between Israel and Palestinian groups has gone into effect following the recent relentless Israeli strikes on the besieged Gaza Strip that killed more than 240 Palestinians, including 65 children. 12 Israelis were killed in retaliatory attacks by Palestinian resistance groups in what has been described as a game changer in the political and military equations of the region. Palestinians have hailed this ceasefire as a major victory for the resistance and all Palestinians. In this edition of the debate, among other issues, we'll look at what Israel and the Palestinian resistance achieved from this conflict.
A ceasefire took hold on Friday in the Gaza Strip as Israel and Hamas agreed to halt nearly 2 weeks of fighting that left hundreds dead and parts of the impoverished Gaza Strip destroyed. There were no reports of violations early Friday, though each side said it stood ready to retaliate for any attacks by the other.
After the ceasefire, I am sending words of thanks and appreciation for the Palestinian resistance and for the countries who supported Palestinians with both money and weapons, especially the Islamic Republic of Iran that offered everything and stood with Palestinians to a great extent.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip took to the streets and held celebrations of their victory, embracing one another in front of bombed buildings. Palestinians in Gaza could not mark Eid al-Fitr festival at Ramadan conclusion due to the Israeli airstrikes. On Friday, postponed Eid celebrations were held throughout Gaza.
This is a celebration of our victory. We celebrate winning and teaching the inhumane Israeli regime a lesson that we won't remain silent over its crimes, even if it costs us everything, even our children and homes. This is the road of our resistance till Palestine is free.
We spent days of Ramadan waiting for aid, and then this escalation started, but we all supported Al-Aqsa and Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. Gazans did all of this to support Palestinians in Jerusalem. We didn't count on any other country. We supported each other and defended Al-Aqsa.
More than 10 days of attacks killed at least 240 Palestinians in Gaza, including 66 children, wounded more than 1,900, and damaged critical infrastructure and thousands of homes, according to officials. The clashes began when the Israeli regime attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and started its eviction plans of Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem.
We are all here now in high spirits. We have witnessed three wars, and today Gaza didn't give up defending Palestinians. We are glad of this victory, and we appreciate the efforts of our resistance that did everything to support us and defend our rights.
After days of Israeli strikes, people are here celebrating their victory, stressing to support the Palestinian resistance in the face of the Israeli violations of Palestinian rights. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Joining us on this debate, we have Middle East affairs expert Karim Sharara joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Sharara, welcome to the program. The reactions are pouring in today. The ceasefire is being celebrated as a victory for Palestinian resistance groups against the Israeli regime. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has also congratulated the Palestinians for this triumph, and he said the Israeli regime is growing weaker by the day. Talk to us more about the leader's views and also how significant this triumph has been.
Well, first, starting off with the leader's views, I think that he highlighted three main points that I think would summarize the entire scene for us and its developments. First of all, the fact that we now have a unified, not just a unified Palestinian intifada, but also a unified Palestinian resistance. This had not happened before. The Palestinian resistance had not coordinated to such an extent. But so for the first time, we have a unified operations room wherein the Palestinian resistance can coordinate its efforts in order to better tackle the Israelis. As for the Intifada, we have never seen such momentum, such bravery on part of the Palestinian people. And this has been something that's been growing for a number of years, because the Israelis had been growing even more and more bold, evicting people from their homes, killing people outright, basically making Palestinians feel even less and less secure. Well, when you get to such a level of security, such a low level of security, the Palestinians have nothing to lose at that moment. So this is the significance of what we've seen today. As for the second point, he also spoke of he also said how the timing of the attacks and the retaliation is now in the hands of the Palestinian resistance. This is also a novel development, because we had always seen that the resistance would fire and we'd wait for the Israeli retaliation so that we'd be able to gauge how things are going. But for the first time, the Palestinian resistance was the one setting the entire agenda of the war. I mean, things reached to a point where they were imposing curfews on the Israelis for all intents and purposes. So the Israeli was as weak and as fragile, the Israeli side was as weak and as fragile as it's ever been. As for the third point, and this was related to the region and the Islamic world, wherein he said that the Islamic, it's a duty but a religious duty to the Islamic for the that the Islamic world support the Palestinian resistance. And I think that this is more of a wink at the at Arab and Islamic countries that are going towards a road of support, not just support, but normalization with the Israelis. Look, the Americans are on a downward spiral, because they can't. I mean, they won't be able to go head to head with the with both the Russians and the Chinese. They're in a losing war. They're in a losing battle. The Israelis are also losing support on a day by day basis. They're growing weaker on a day by day basis. And then you have these regimes completely going against the wills of their people. Choosing to ally themselves with the Israelis. Look, this is our house. This is our home. The Israelis are on a downward spiral. They're effectively being they're effectively dissolving from the inside. And you always know that the house always wins.
Okay, stay
so
with us, Mr.
You should
Shahada.
Bet on the house and not on the other side.
Stay with us now, journalist and political commentator Julia Qassem is joining us on the line now from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Ms. Qassem, welcome to the program. Hamas's Ismail Haniyeh called this ceasefire a victory for all Palestinians, highlighting the much-lauded Palestinian unity in the face of the recent Israeli aggression. Our correspondent in Gaza said it many times that this is the most united Palestinians have been in recent times. How important is it to see this level of Palestinian unity?
As you mentioned, that all Palestinian resistance factions, as well as Palestinians, you know, the popular, the people across the West Bank and Gaza are united and have been united in this campaign of resistance. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine have all been coordinating excellently and working together in coordinating strikes that have hit major military and production facilities and targets across the occupying entity. And this has actually forced Israel to take a ceasefire. The resistance didn't want or didn't ask for a ceasefire. A few days ago, Palestinian Islamic Jihad leader Ziad Nahali said that he doesn't want a ceasefire until the liberation of Jerusalem is at least a guarantee. But, of course, we can see that Israel's like decision to go into a ceasefire is a admission of defeat from its part, that it cannot even compete with the Palestinian resistance that has been operating out of Gaza throughout this 11-day campaign. So we see that the Palestinian resistance has been more united and more coordinated than ever, and at the same time, it's been stronger than ever. It barely even exhausted its old stockpiles that it was using to bring the Zionist entity to its knees and to the point of a ceasefire, let alone what could have happened if the Gazan resistance had brought in its allies regionally to confront the Zionist entity alongside it. Or to really bring out the newer, heavier-grade weaponry. Now, this is why it's considered a victory from the Palestinian end. Not because this is the total endpoint and this is the ultimate objective. The ultimate objective is the liberation of Palestine, but this represents an incremental victory that is further pushing the Zionist entity and its objectives back, which it has not been able to achieve
11 days. Mr. Shahada, looking at the intensified Palestinian rocket attacks against Israeli targets, do you think the retaliation, it change the overall dynamics of the situation if the Israelis are now more concerned for their security?
Well, look, if you look at the developments on the internal front, you'll see that the resistance has been able to target critical Israeli infrastructure, critical Israeli facilities. So, yes, of course, the Israelis are growing even more worried because not only has the resistance been able to reach these new targets all around Israel, all around the occupied territories. But they still have more things up their sleeve, and the Israelis can only suspect as to what these developments or what these capabilities may be. I think what concerns the Israelis, of course, they're concerned. They have this concern, and it's a very urgent concern. But the major development that occurred in this war was the fact that the unrest is no longer limited to the Gaza front, but has spread all throughout the occupied territories. So, I mean, and I think this rings true with what the leader said a few years back on the need to arm the West Bank, because what we've seen from this round of war was an activation or a new development on that front. The Israelis are more concerned on their internal front, because look, the major selling point that Israel had throughout these years was their Iron Dome and their the fact that they've been able to control their internal security so well for these years. And this myth, for all intents and purposes, has crumbled in this war. So they can no longer guarantee their security on the domestic level. So how long will the Israelis be? I mean, how can you counter an angry populace? How can you counter entire regions of people willing to stand up to you and your supposed citizens and your settlements, willing to die because they no longer have security? If you can't do anything about it, if you can't guarantee your citizen security, so right. When that myth crumbles, you're going to see droves of people flying out of Israel or escaping Israel, escaping the occupied territories, because this regime can no longer do anything to secure their presence.
Julie Qassem, Hamas's Ismail Haniyeh thanked Iran for their financial and arms support. To what extent can support from countries like Iran boost the resistance against the Israeli attacks and aggression? All right, I believe we've lost that connection. Let's address that question to Mr. Sharada. Karim, please give us your response to that question. I'll just repeat it again. Ismail Haniyeh thanked Iran in particular for their financial and arms support. To what extent, in your opinion, can support from countries like Iran boost the resistance in the face of the Israeli attacks and aggression?
Okay, so one of the main things about Iran's support is, first of all, it's not conditional. It's as if you were to support an ally that you fully entrust with the ability to manage their own front. Why I'm saying this is because the Americans wouldn't do the same thing for the Saudis. The Americans, first of all, see the Saudis as a consumer economy, and this is a market for them, so where they can sell their weapons and at the same time guarantee their own presence in the region. That's not the way Iran looks at Palestinian or resistance movements in general. The way Iran deals with things is, we're prepared to supply you with whatever you need to not only to survive but to emerge victorious. And not only that, we're also prepared to give you the know-how so that you can develop these weapons on your own. And this is what Hamas leaders have always stated, that not only has Iran been supportive of us, either financially or logistically, but they have also given us the know-how so that we can create these missiles on our own. And this is something that we've seen in Yemen, for example, although Iran is not involved in Yemen, but the Yemenis are manufacturing these missiles on their own. So to answer your questions, Iran is not only at the backbone of the resistance in the region, it's also given resistance movements such a great margin in their own autonomy that they're that they know how to deal with matters themselves. They know what weapons to manufacture. They know what to do. And without the support of Iran, we wouldn't have gotten to what we to where we are today. I mean, if it wasn't for Iran and its support for Hezbollah, we wouldn't have had a liberated southern Lebanon. If it wasn't for Iran's support of Hezbollah, we wouldn't have had Hezbollah pose such a great threat to the Israeli regime that they're more concerned about Hezbollah than they are about Gaza. If it wasn't for Iran's support for Hezbollah, then you wouldn't have had a transfer of experience or a sharing of experience among different resistance movements in the entire region.
Right. Karim Sharara, Hamas has called on the international community to help rebuild Gaza. Here's this is a very important question, a main question personally for myself as well. Does the international community want to help in rebuilding Gaza? If so, why is it not happening?
Well, it depends what you mean by the international community. If by international community you mean the major powers, the G7, countries in the Security Council, well, this isn't going to happen because it's not in their interest to support, to rebuild Gaza and strengthen it against the Israelis. I mean, they want the Gazans shattered. They want the Gazans demoralized. They want Gazans to see death all around them, and just they want Gazans to die. If by international community you mean the people of the world, not their governments, well, then you would have a totally different answer, because the scene that we've seen over the developments that we've seen over the years, especially in this year, where it's so clear to everyone that the Israelis were the aggressors, and they had no international cover, or no moral cover, no ethical cover whatsoever. I mean, they never did, but it was so clear this time. I think that in the near future, not yet anyway, we may see campaigns of people, of droves of people heading towards Gaza to help with rebuilding it. You may have individual individual people partaking in fundraisers. You may have groups of people just going to share expertise. You may have a number of volunteer organizations going to rebuild Gaza. But do we expect anything on the international scene? I mean, unless it's a country that's deeply invested in resistance, and we know for sure that the Israelis will be unable to do anything about it, then we're not going to see anything of a sort. They want Gazans to die. They want the Palestinians to die. They want the Israelis to survive. They want the Israelis to rain death upon us all. Of course, this isn't going to happen, but, I mean, they have their own right to wishful thinking. That's not going to happen.
All right, let's end it on that note. Middle East affairs expert Karim Sharara joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also thanks to journalist and political commentator Julia Kassem speaking to us on the line from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, as well. Also, special thanks to her for staying with us on this debate. It's a good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to a United Nations World Food Program WF report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Robin Scher, writer. This article is published under the heading, Pandemic may have left 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. Here's more. According to a United Nations World Food Program report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. The combined effect of the pandemic as well as the emerging global recession could, without large-scale coordinated action, disrupt the functioning of food systems, which would result in consequences for health and nutrition of a severity and a scale unseen for more than half a century, states another UN report. In the United States, food insecurity has doubled overall and tripled among households with children due to the pandemic, states a June 2020 report by the Institute for Policy Research, IPR, at Northwestern University, which relied on data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey. In a recent interview with CBS News, IPR Director Diane Whitmore warned that these statistics would likely continue to hold, with the numbers indicating particularly dramatic rises in food insecurity among Black and Latino families. Indeed, families of color are being disproportionately impacted. According to an analysis of new census data by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, 22% of Black and 21% of Latino respondents reported not having enough to eat, compared to just 9% with white people. Globally, the effects of COVID-19 on food security are equally, if not more, severe. According to a CBS News report, WFP Director David Beasley told the UN Security Council in April 2020 that the world is on the brink of a hunger pandemic. He added, in a worst-case scenario, we could be looking at famine in about 36 countries. And in fact, in 10 of these countries, we already have more than 1 million people per country who are on the verge of starvation. The number of chronically hungry people increased by an estimated 130 million last year to more than 800 million, about eight times the total number of COVID-19 cases to date, wrote Mark Lowcock, the Under Secretary General and Emergency Relief Coordinator at the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and Alex Van Trottenberg, Managing Director of Operations at the World Bank. Countries affected by conflict and climate change are particularly vulnerable to food insecurity. Empty stomachs can stunt whole generations. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, warns that climate change is likely to diminish continued progress on global food security through production disruptions that lead to local availability limitations and price increases, interrupted transport conduits, and diminished food safety. The same might be said about the pandemic, which has made it abundantly clear. Climate resilience, food security, and global health are closely intertwined. In terms of food security, another major concern is the pandemic-related school closures that have occurred across the globe, with UNICEF reporting that more than 1.6 billion children and young people have been affected. Schools provide a food lifeline for children. For so many, that is where they get their only nutritious meal of the day. In January, UNICEF and WFP released a new report that found that more than 39 billion in school meals have been missed worldwide since the pandemic began, with 370 million children worldwide having missed 40% of in-school meals. In early 2020, when COVID-19 was still a looming specter rather than the deadly virus we are more familiar with today, the threat of food insecurity was a practical problem. Scenes of shoppers descending on aisles to stock up on supplies was a common sight. As CNN reported in March 2020, supermarkets around the world rationed food and other products such as toilet paper and cleaning supplies in an effort to curb stockpiling. In Vermont, for instance, a steady increase in food insecurity since the start of the pandemic has correlated to employment levels, according to a survey conducted by the University of Vermont between March and April 2020. Approximately 45% of respondents had either lost their jobs, been furloughed, or had their hours reduced during the pandemic. And a further two-thirds of survey participants who recorded scarcity of food in their households had experienced job losses or work disruptions since the outbreak of the pandemic, according to the survey. Vermont is just one example. The impact has been felt across the U.S. during the week before Thanksgiving last year. The Guardian reported that 5.6 million U.S. households struggled to put enough food on the table, while referring to the analysis of the census data by CBPP. As the pandemic continues to upend lives across the world, it has impacted the entire food supply chain, with factory and supermarket workers being highly susceptible to COVID-19. There has been a commitment decline in food production and a rise in prices. As Scott Faber, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at Environmental Working Group, EWG, reported, farmers across the U.S. were already facing labor shortages prior to the pandemic. And with tightened immigration as well as the heightened risk and poor compensation associated with these jobs, food processors and farm labor contractors may struggle to find other workers willing to risk their lives to work in meat plants, packing sheds, or produce fields. The pandemic has exposed the weakness of the industrialized global food system, which depends on long, complex transportation chains and cross-border travel. The monstrous and unsustainable food industry known as Big Ag relies on the horrendous treatment of laborers, a wasteful allocation of resources, worldwide environmental devastation, and in a pinch, can quickly devolve into near collapse of the entire system, as evidenced by the delays, shortages, and pressure during the COVID-19 pandemic and the deepening hunger crisis in America. April M. Short, a fellow at the Independent Media Institute, recently wrote in Salon, "Among the many necessary systematic changes, 2020 has illuminated the need to majorly restructure the way we cultivate and access food in our communities. It didn't take the pandemic to reveal the inefficiency and injustice of the food system. Globally, a third of all food is wasted, while nearly 690 million people were undernourished in 2019, almost 60 million more people than in 2014. But the pandemic has underscored matter. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the number of acutely food insecure people could increase to 270 million due to COVID-19, representing an 82% increase compared to the number of acutely food insecure people pre-COVID-19. And the disruption of transportation has shown that the long distances it normally takes for food to get from one place to another can be a serious liability during a crisis. Food banks are under tremendous pressure to meet the skyrocketing demand, wrote Claire Bainbow Fonaut, Feeding America CEO, and Zippy Duval, president of the American Farm Bureau, to then Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue in April of last year. At the same time, however, we are seeing literally tons of agricultural goods being discarded because of the shutdown of so much of the economy. Consumer demand has shifted from eating out at restaurants and food services away from home, and food supply chain operations have had to be retooled. And that impact has been felt within the transportation sector. Forbes reported that Andrew Novoik, an agricultural economist at Cornell University, points to a number of weak spots in the food transportation system that could be aggravated by the increased demand for food. A shortage of truck drivers is one potential weak spot, says Novoik. Although he concedes there is debate on this matter, he maintains that trucking companies are finding it much harder to recruit those long-haul drivers. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, an intergovernmental economic group with 37 member countries, said that the pandemic has laid bare pre-existing gaps in social protection systems in a report published in June 2020. While the impacts of COVID-19 are still unfolding, experience so far shows the importance of an open and predictable international trade environment to ensure food can move to where it is needed, the OECD report states. The biggest risk for food security is not with food availability, but with consumers' access to food. Safety nets are essential to avoid an increase in hunger and food insecurity. Another problem is the lack of media coverage about the food insecurity being witnessed around the world, particularly during the COVID-19 era. As The Economist recently pointed out, journalists in 2020 wrote more than 50,000 articles about the cancelled Eurovision contest, but only around 2,000 about drought and hunger in Zambia.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.